Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. Pardes is pleased to present the third episode of our new podcast series by Rabbi Daniel Landis, Unexpected Encounters, the Jewish Holidays and the Other. This episode is on Shavuot, and its title is Shavuot, Kedushat HaKotel. We appreciate the assistance of the Alexander Soros Foundation, the sponsor for the series. There is a handout for this podcast that I'm sending as the next podcast episode, so please print that out and follow along with Rabbi Daniel Landes. Rabbi Landes is the director of the Pardes Institute in Jerusalem, and now Rabbi Daniel Landes.
Thank you, Larry. The discussion today is continuing our festival series. Is discuss something that's done on the festival, and that is to go up, all festivals, is to go up to the Beit HaMikdash, to go up to the temple. The verses in the Bible talk about you shall be seen three times a year, the pilgrimage festivals. What's about the place of pilgrimage, and more specifically, something which does relate to Shavuot holiday, and that is the fact that overwhelming numbers of Jews go to, after studying the whole night, go up in Jerusalem, go up, and they go to the temple grounds, or near the temple grounds, to be much more accurate and precise. And they go to the Kotel, they go to the wall. And I want to talk about the holiness of the wall. And certainly this is important in terms of present-day discussion of who should go to the wall, what part of the wall, how should prayer be at the wall. Just Google, you'll find a lot of information. I will not talk from the aspect of sociology or politics. I won't even talk in the aspect of traditionalism versus rites, or some sort of spirituality or prophetic notions. I want to see what is the halachic legal understanding of the holiness and theological holiness of the Kotel, of the wall. What could that possibly mean? To do that, you have to spend time discussing what really is the holiness of that which is inside the walls, Har HaBayit, Temple Mount. I will be using some specific terms, I'll translate it, but Har HaBayit is a very good term to know. Temple Mount, that's literally what it means. So we're going to be looking at Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, his great summation of Jewish law, 14 separate books. Each book has a theme, and in the book of Avodah, of Divine Service, it has many chapters, including one on, the initial one, on Beit HaBechira, the chosen house, meaning the temple, meaning the Beit HaMikdash, to use the Hebrew term. And Maimonides begins in the first chapter, in Halacha 1, which is a subsection, and we will do a rapid review. But don't worry, you'll understand, and you'll understand things much better now. It's a positive commandment to construct a house for God. There's supposed to be a Beit HaMikdash. It's not a mistake. But it says, Vasuli Mikdash, you shall make for me a Mikdash, a holy spot. The M, or Mem, means a place of Kiddusha, a place of holiness, of sanctity. I've separated it out for holiness. And the first example or manifestation of Mikdash was the Mishkan. I'm still looking at 1-1. You can follow along with me. Constructed by Moses. And that's Mem, meaning place of, Makom, Shachan, or Shechina, the place in which the divine presence dwelled. And this was temporary. When they entered the land, they erected a Mishkan in Gilgal for 14 years. Shiloh with stones at 369 years, but no roof. And afterwards to Givon, and from Givon, relatively shortly, to the temple. And now we begin the temple, the first temple, built in Jerusalem. A house of God, and now we're in 1-3, to offer sacrifices. And it became forbidden to build it anywhere else. One spot. This is the house of the Lord, God, and this is the altar for the burnt offerings, David declares. In Halacha 1:5, they do a very important thing, and that is to define the terms of that which was on the Har Habayit. And I will look at a couple of things with you. If you look over at the chart, Second Temple diagram, we have here a rough diagram of what was understood to be the important parts of the Har Habayit. So look at this, and you see that A tells us the walls of the Har Habayit, the defining walls that define the area inside. And then what I'd like to look with you, and I'm not looking at the whole thing, just looking at part, we'll come back to all the parts, is that at the very center of it all, if you look at N refers to the Heichal, which was an entryway. Probably better off if I had written there Kadosh, the holy spot, which leads to O, which is the Holy of Holies. You know, the high priest only went there once a year, and that was in Yom Kippur. There are some alleyways, as it were, little courtyards, notion by P. M is the Ulam, that is the entrance hall. When you put those together, well, look at the number. Let's go back to Maimonides, Halacha 1:5 on page 1. The following elements are essential when constructing this house. The Kadosh, that's really N, also called Heichal. The Kadosh HaKadoshim, which was the Holy of Holies. And preceding the sanctuary, there was a place called Ha'ulam, the entrance hall. And altogether, despite the fact there's a little place called Heichal, the three together are called writ large Heichal, as Maimonides says. Three together are called the Heichal. In addition, we make another partition around the Heichal, set off from it slightly, resembling the curtains around the courtyard in the sanctuary in the desert. Everything encompassed by this partition is called the Azara, the courtyard, and that whole arena. And the entire area, everything really from D through Q, and we'll see some of these soon, all that is called the Mikdash, or the Beit HaMikdash. Let's go back. A are the walls of the Har Habayit. B is what's called Har Habayit, and it has a diffuse sanctity. And this is the arena that I need to show to you right now. And this is the arena in which all these important things take place. We'll go a little bit more intimately involved in a moment. Let's go to page 2. The entire Mikdash was not built on flat ground. It was built on an incline of Mount Moriah. This mountain that it's on is called Mount Moriah. Thus, a person who entered from the eastern gate of the Har Habayit of the Temple Mount would proceed to the end of the Chael on one level. He would ascend from the Chael to the women's courtyard on 12 steps. Each step was half a cubit high and half a cubit wide. Look at your page. You have the eastern gate. You know, we're looking, entering the eastern gate. The eastern gate is really the opposite of the way most people experience the Har Habayit, the Temple Mount, because most people experience through the Kotel. And the Kotel is really on the opposite side, is on the west, is the western wall. So you enter and you get this area called C, which we have C, which is a chel. Chel is basically kind of like a ramp. It was a question whether or not the chel extended all the way around the entire Mikdash, this whole holiness, or at least when you went through the chel, it's kind of like a speed bump. Take care, understand where you're going into, and you walk into D. D is the Ezrat Nashim, the courtyard for the women. And then one once goes through there, assuming one's going through, and you go to E, Ezrat Yisrael, a relatively much smaller place. It was a courtyard for the men. And then through there, we get to F, is the courtyard for the priests, Ezrat Kohanim. There, in this whole place, is where you have I and H, and what that is, H being the altar, and I being the ramp up the altar, what you have after that spot, you have kind of like this open area between the entranceway and this mizbeach, this altar that you have left, or between the altar and the entranceway would be better. M is the entranceway. And then, as I said, N, which should be called Kadosh. O is the Kadosh Kadoshim, the holy spot. All this is in an incline going up, or mostly on the incline going up. Let's go back to Maimonides. So we have gone through the temple courtyard. We've gone through we began by going through the Eastern Gate. We've gone through the Ezrat Nashim, which is D. We have gone through the courtyard of Israelites, which is E. All through here using 15 steps. Each step was half a cubit high and half a cubit wide. Now, how much is a cubit? A cubit, which in Hebrew is amah, a cubit is 45.6 centimeters. 45.6 centimeters. This is going to be very important in a moment. One would proceed through the entire Israelite courtyard on one level and ascend from it to Ezrat Kohanim, one step, one cubit high. Then there was a step, a platform of three steps. Each step was half a cubit high and half a cubit wide. The priestly courtyard, Ezrat Kohanim, was 2.5 cubits higher than Ezrat Yisrael, than the courtyard of the Israelites. One proceed through the entirely priest courtyard, and you be into the area of the altar, the Mizbeach, and the space up to the Ulam and the altar on one side. From there, one would ascend to the entrance hall, the Ulam, using 12 steps. Each step was half a cubit high and half a cubit wide. The Ulam, the entranceway, and the remainder of the Heichal, that whole temple building, were both on the same level. 6-5, really important. I've given you a lot of numbers. They're going to come together. Thus, the ground in which the Heichal, the temple building, was located, was 22 cubits higher than the ground on which you started, the Shaar Mizrach, the Eastern Gate. So 22 cubits, and I said that each cubit was 45.6 centimeters. So what you get, basically, 22 cubits high is 1,003.22 centimeters, which, of course, translates to 10.32 meters. And for those who think in terms of feet, that's 33 and roughly 9-tenths feet. 10.32 meters, 33.9-tenths feet, is the height in which, when you're there where the Heichal is, where the temple, the real temple building is, when you're there, that's how much higher you are from where you began. I asked my students, what do you call this? And one said, and she was right, this is an elevating experience. And I believe it's an elevating experience in a whole other way of understanding it. It's an elevating experience as if, well, let me take you to another section. The section is on page 6. We're going to do some of these intervening pages as well. And just see something very quickly. And we're on page 6. Halacha, this is Halacha 7:14. Therefore, it's chapter 7, Halacha 14 of that chapter 7. Jerusalem was holier than the other walled cities. Walled cities were considered to have a sanctity because they were designated as a specific spot. And there, for example, we can eat the sacrifices of lesser sanctity and second tithes within its walls. Second tithes was kind of the agricultural tithe you took out. Many of the other tithes went to the poor. They went to the Levites. This tithe went to yourself and said, take this foodstuff or its economic monetary equivalent plus 20% and go spend time in Jerusalem because we're concerned about Jerusalem. Turn the page. We're now on page 7. Halacha 7:15, the second paragraph. The Temple Mount, remember that whole wide area of D, the Temple Mount is holier than the city of Jerusalem. Okay. Because even though it was a wide area, and it was an area that many, many different types of people could attend, it's still considered a greater sanctity. Later on, the rabbis forbade a dead person, for a corpse, for being there, as one example. The chel, that speed bump that that I'm talking about, is holier than the Temple Mount. The woman's courtyard, so the chel is C. D, the woman's courtyard, is holier than the chel. It's a very wide area. E, the courtyard, now we're going to 718, courtyard of the Israelites, holier than the is even holier. The 719, the priestly courtyard, the Ezrat Kohanim, is holier. The area between the altar and the ulam is holier. Now, the way priests, let me give you an example. Priests who have physical deformities have grown long hair, in some ways are not easy for people to look at, or whose priestly garments are torn, may not enter there, because you need some form of perfection. 721, the Heichal, the temple building, is holier than the area, that the area before. Only a priest who has sanctified his hands and feet can enter there. 722, the chamber of the Holy of Holies is holier than it. Only the high priest can enter there on Yom Kippur. So we have the experience of who's going up and who's going through the doors. You have the experience of constant greater holiness. Or, to quote my students, elevation. It's an elevating experience, both physically and in terms of holiness. There's a experiential element that's happening here. People come and they're supposed to feel their holiness. They should know their place. And here I say that ironically, because everybody has a place. B is highly open to people. D, the place for women, and one can have all sorts of argumentation about specification of spot. But notice that D is a very large spot. People are allowed to have access. People, there's a kind of transparency in this access as well. So here we have this holiness, and now I want to go to a further definition of what this holiness means from, again, from a rabbinic perspective. So now you have to turn back for me. I have to turn back for myself as well. And let us go to, well, let's go to page 5. And the one thing that I'm skipping is the fact that there are really two types of holinesses that are discussed here. The one type of holiness that is discussed is the holiness that is defined by being just part of the land of Israel. The land of Israel's holiness is a holiness which was really predicated upon it being dedicated as a holy land. The first holiness is understood as the holiness that has been created by the conquest of Joshua. When Joshua, and that first time, and also his successors, came into the land, understood how the land was, they made a decision that this land should be holy. But since it was a holiness based on conquest, in fact, let's go back for a moment. Let's go to page 3. Come back with me to page 3. I know I'm shuffling you along from spot to spot, but I hope I'm still going to be a good tour guide for you. That in Halacha 6:14, chapter 6, number 14, it talks about how there is holiness. Now, the second holiness, say about the first holiness of Joshua, but the problem with the first holiness of Joshua, that it was based on conquest, and once another nation conquered that land, the full understanding is that it was as if the land lost its holiness. Only to achieve it again in the time of Ezra and that whole movement to rebuild the temple and to rebuild the land of Israel, in which the holiness was done through what's called chazakah, through living continuously and building the land. And this was a second type of dedication. And that holiness is the holiness that we live in too. But there's a third type of holiness. And that holiness based on the fact that it's that it was done by Chazakah, by building the land, understanding the land, that never went away. That never emptied itself of its holiness. But the temple had a third type of holiness, according to Maimonides. Maimonides, if you look at in the middle of 614, how was the second temple consecrated? Well, it was already consecrated with the first consecration performed by Solomon. For he consecrated the temple courtyard in Jerusalem for that time and for eternity. That the first consecration of the temple was not in the time of Joshua, nor is it subject to losing its holiness because of conquest, nor did it need a second consecration in the time of Ezra through Chazakah, through living in the land. A totally different type of scheme. With the first consecration performed by Solomon, for he consecrated the temple courtyard of Azarah and the Jerusalem for that time and for eternity. Now we go to a argument on Maimonides. The great commentator on Maimonides, who's really rough on the Rambam, the name of a movie we make about the Ravid, Ibn Daud, Rabbi Abraham Ibn Daud, Maimonides, rough on Maimonides. Maimonides, rough writer. The first consecration performed by Solomon, a quote from the Maimonides text, the Ravad, Rabbi Abraham Ibn Daud, 1125-98, says, impossible. Maimonides is only stating his own opinion. I don't know where he got it. Because there's many places stated in the Mishnah, the great rabbinic text, edited and published in 200 CE, many years earlier than the Mishnah Torah, that's for sure. And in other places in the real Mishnah, it teaches if there is no Mikdash, if there is no temple building, the consecration decays. Im ein Mikdash yirak kev. If there is no Mikdash, the whole thing rots or decays and is emptied. Because that's the thing. Once it is gone, the temple buildings, it has no thing. Therefore, he says, there's a real practical difference, according to Maimonides, in which the temple retains its whole temple ground, retains its holiness, even if no part of it is left, but it's been consecrated. Well, a person who is impure, tamei, spiritually impure, and the greatest form of spiritual impurity is contact, because it's a form of alienation, is contact with a corpse. And therefore you have to go through an amazing ceremony of being repurified by the ashes of the red heifer. And without that, you can't go there. Whether it's at the time in which the buildings are up, and they're doing sacrifices, whether it's the time the buildings are down, they're not doing sacrifices, it doesn't matter, according to Maimonides. You go there, you've done something wrong, and the punishment is correct, spiritual excision, because you have been insensitive to what this ground means. But the Ravad says something, very different. The Ravad says, this is what he says, we'll just say it again, that as long as the ground does not contain the buildings, as long as the ground does not contain the buildings, the holiness has rotted, it's decayed, it is no longer there. If there is no Mikdash, the consecration decays. Now Maimonides has not agreed to this about the decaying. Maimonides says it never decays. And therefore, if you go there, you have the punishment of karet. You have spiritually cut yourself off from the Jewish people, because you realize that a holy spot like that, you cannot come tainted by death. But Ravat says, no problem, because there will be in a future time a consecration. But at this time right now, there is no consecration. And therefore, that note of the Ravad that we have in 614 at the end of that second paragraph there. So it's been revealed to me. Therefore, one who enters there now is not subject to excision, not subject to karet, and has no holiness. So depending upon how you want to read this, you got all sorts of different ways of seeing what's going on. Big difference, one form or another. We will continue with Maimonides. Became the dominant viewpoint. Ravad's viewpoint is extremely important, not only in giving the alternative, the opposite view in which you can then understand both ways, but the Ravad's view is extraordinarily important because maybe we need to take use of that at some point. Maybe that should be the direction we go in. But right now, we will continue with Maimonides, which has been the dominant opinion. And the question that we can have here now is, if we go like Maimonides, let me repeat what that means, that the place is still holy, the place is still sanctified, the place still has its consecration. It means you can't walk there, you can't go in there if you have subject to being close to a corpse. And the general assumption is that we all have. We've all been in spots, we've been either direct contact with a corpse, or we've been in a building in which there's a corpse, we've been to funerals, corpse inside the building, and therefore you're in a state of spiritual alienation, and therefore you cannot go into Har HaBayit. You can't go into the Temple Mount at all. You certainly cannot go into the Mikdash. So what do we do? Well, we can still hold it in awe. If we're going to go back a couple of pages to page 6, you may be in front of me or behind me. Look at 7:7 on page 6. Chapter 7, Halacha 7. Even though the temple is now in ruin because of our sins, a person should hold its site in awe, as one should regard it when it was standing. Should only enter a region if he happens to be there near Har HaBayit, which he's permitted to enter. He should not sit in the area of the Azara, because it's considered to be not showing respect. Should not act frivolously, even when he's standing before the place of Shar HaMizrach, even when he hasn't even fully entered Eastern Gate, because he's close to where the sanctuary is. In the verse, you shall revere my sanctuary. The sanctuary referring to that Kodesh, or Mikdashai Tiro, that holy spot. And the sages commented, well, the whole verse is, Etchap Totai Tishmero V'Mikdashai Tiro, My Sabbaths, you shall guard, and my Mikdash, my temple building, you shall fear. And they say it's kind of like a time-space continuum. That just as there is a place in time that must be fully revered, Shabbat, and guarded, so too there's a spot on earth that always should be revered and guarded forever. So in 7:8, when the temple is standing, a person may not act frivolously from the area of Mount Scopus, which is outside Jerusalem, and inwards towards the city. Prohibition only applies when one can see the temple. Maybe it's not a prohibition today, but there are people who see the temple. They see it with their imagination. They see it with their mind's eye. And now, from this point on, we talk about the holiness spot that we mentioned earlier, that Jerusalem is holier in terms of the sacrifices. No corpses left in its boundaries. There shouldn't be furnaces because of air pollution. It's supposed to be a special, special spot, which is one of the reasons is people are so careful about Jerusalem. Why many people who are not Sabbath observant outside Jerusalem, still when they come to Jerusalem, they're Sabbath observant. There's a reason why people come to Jerusalem on all sorts of tours and all sorts of birthright groups and everything like that. They don't want to spend the Sabbath in Tel Aviv. They want to spend it in Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is the spot. And then if you look, and it continues, we went through everything that we went through, 7:15, the Temple Mount, the Chael, that speed bump, the woman's courtyard. So if you go back to your diagram and you look at the diagram, you even turn it around upside down so the west is facing you, and you look at what Maimonides says completely, what is missing? Seems to be complete. You probably gave the answer already. What's missing is the Kotel, the Western Wall, this whole spot that we're talking about. It doesn't show up in Maimonides. And Maimonides is a summation. It doesn't show up in the commentators who like to pounce on Maimonides and say, oh, Maimonides, you forgot this or you forgot that. No, no, no. It's not there. It wasn't that it wasn't forgotten. It's not on the radar. The Kotel is not on the radar. Because from a halachic point of view, from a legal point of view, which we'll come back to, you can say it one or two ways. According to the Rav Adib and Dao that we saw, even the Temple Mount with its various sites is no longer holy. We believe that it will achieve re-achieve a holiness in time to come. But if you go into the more, I don't know if you want to call it conservative or even expansive view of Maimonides, which the place retains its holiness, that holiness stops where? It stops at A, all the way around. It stops at the walls of the Har Habayit. So whether it's a southern wall or a northern wall or the eastern wall or the western wall, there is no holiness. So what does this, all this have to do? What's all this stuff that we've been talking about and seeing these days in which you go to the western wall and you see how people pray and you see how people are concerned? What does this all have to mean? And people have been very careful not to go up to the temple. Let's take a look on page 10. Maybe I'll go with you a little bit earlier. Let's look at this section from Echa Rabbah, Lamentations Rabbah. That's a midrash, the fanciful and incredibly imaginative stories and interpretations that the rabbis had, based on the Book of Lamentations, talking about the destruction of the temple. Instead of page 10, I think I'll go with you to page 9. On page 9, at the top, a Roman general had said to Jerusalem notables, had said to Vespasian himself, Vespasian was the soon to become emperor, and he was the main general-in-chief, executive-in-chief, who was leading the attack on Jerusalem and the siege. And the Lamentation said there were backdoor discussions of Jerusalem notables who knew the language, who knew how to discuss with people, were talking to Vespasian. And in one spot, Vespasian seems ready to spare the city, or at the very least, to spare the great temple. And one of the generals says, no, 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 you got to destroy the whole thing. There are rebels. The rebels are kind of a snake. There's a lot of parables here. You got to get rid of them all. Notables say, how terrible can you be to us? But the Roman general, again, on page 9, Vespasian's underling, says, saying to the Jews, I seek your welfare. So long as the temple exists, the heathen kingdoms will attack you. But if it is destroyed, they will not attack you. Oh, my gosh. We will save you by destroying the thing that's most precious to you. And what you really have here is the Midrash's understanding of how vulnerable the Jewish condition is and how vulnerable the temple is. The temple is a magnet for religions. We know that, certainly. For religions, for spiritual people, and by virtue of the fact that it's a magnet, it becomes all that more vulnerable. Almost a destructive impulse takes over people. Those who can't have it want to destroy it. And this applies to the external condition of the Jewish people, to whom we face, and internally within the Jewish people. And if I can't have it in my way, I'm ready to destroy it. And it applies, unfortunately, to all sorts of groups. Vespasian said, the Roman general in charge, who later soon became emperor during this period of time, said to the chief leader of the Jewish people, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, make a request of me and I will grant it. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, I beg you abandon the city of Jerusalem and depart. Vespasian says, I can't do that. Did the Romans proclaim me now as king that I should abandon the city? At that point, Yochanan ben Zakkai says, okay, I have a different request. Leave at least the western gate, which leads to Lod, to Lydia, and allow everyone who departs to the fourth hour to be spared. So we'll leave. We'll leave this remnant. Vespasian is introduced at this point to Rabbi Tzadok. Rabbi Tzadok was brought to the city gate. When he arrived, Rabbi Yochanan stood up before him. Vespasian says, you stand up before this emaciated old man? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai responds, by your life, if there had been in Jerusalem one more like him, and if he had doubled the army, he would not have been able to conquer it. What is his power? Vespasian asks. And the answer is, by Yochanan ben Zakkai about Rabbi Tzadok, he eats one fig and the strength of it teaches at least 100 sessions in the academy. In other words, that there's great power within the people who are able to renunciate everything else except their spirituality and their holiness. And this becomes the power. And the power within that whole temple realm is the power of focusing on what's important and giving up everything else. The temple is destroyed. Bottom paragraph 9. When Vespasian subdued the city, he assigned destruction of its four ramparts to the four generals. Western gate was allotted to Pangar. Pangar is that general who was ready, who urged the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem. Now it had been decreed by heaven that this should never be destroyed because Shekhinah abides in the west. The Shekhinah abode in the west. It's a well-known saying of the rabbis. I don't fully understand it myself, but this is the place, the part where God still has a presence. The others demolished his sections, but he didn't demolish his. Vespasian sent for him. Why did you not destroy your section? He said, well, by your life, my general, my emperor, ask yourself for the honor of the kingdom, for I had demolished it. Nobody would, in time to come, know that it was you who had destroyed it. But when people now will look at the Western Wall, they'll say, ah, look at the might of Vespasian. He destroyed Jerusalem and everything else. Two definitions of the Western Wall. One is the place of the Shekhinah, the place of God's dwelling, the remaining part where God dwells, or the fact that this is a symbol of destruction itself. And both have played this part in Jewish consciousness. Just as the whole notion of asceticism and renunciation and spirituality has played a role, a much greater role than many moderns will attest to, but how much more so that has this, and the knowledge that Jerusalem, and especially the temple, is a magnet for spirituality, and obsessive magnets in which people are almost ready to kill each other for it. And finally, this dual notion that the Western Wall is, on one hand, the place of spirituality, the Shekhinah dwells in the West, but at the same time, it's a symbol of fragility and destruction. The great Ramban, Moshe ben Nachman, not Maimonides, another doctor, another philosopher, another halachic thinker, he came to Eretz Yisrael, and he writes in one of his sermons, I saw the destroyed, desolate city, and when I arrived opposite the great house refers to the Beit HaMikdash, the temple building, and the Kadosh, that second section, we read with many sobs the liturgical poem, Our Holy House and Our Splendor, and about the great destruction. And later on, something like, you know, a few years later, he was born, and then later in his life, Rabbi Ishtori HaParchi, who wrote Kaftar V'Ferach, self went to Israel. So himself was a great advocate for rebuilding, said about the Ramban. He would not go further than those walls of the Temple Mount because of the prohibitions. He, the Ramban himself, Nachmanides, was in Jerusalem where he investigated and visited all the spots of our holy land. But it's a testimony of how far you can go, and you can't go any further. So the area outside is the area, the last place we can go without going up, without entering a spot that we can't really enter because we are afraid of violating His holiness because of this tumat hames, this impurity of death that clings to us. In Exodus Rabbah, also a Midrashic statement, it quotes from Song of Songs. Song of Songs, number 9. My beloved is like a gazelle, a young hart, and who's speaking is the Shulamite. Metaphorically, we always understand the Shulamite to refer to the people of Israel. She is the people of Israel. Behold, he should be with a capital H, because the beloved, who's like a gazelle in young heart, stands behind our wall, O Meid Achar Kotelenu Ar Kotel. He looks in through the window, he peers through the latticework. We can almost see him, but he can see us. And therefore Rabbi Acha in that midrash, the last paragraph on the page, says the Shekhinah never departs from the western wall. As written, behold, he still stands. He's standing now behind our wall. I remember very soon after the Six-Day War, when I began my studies in the land of Israel, being there at the Kotel, redeemed after all these years in which Jews could stand there freely, singing to this song and dancing, He nehezeh omeid achar kotelenu, behold, he stands behind our wall. And with great intensity. So how's the wall to be understood? From a halachic point of view, the wall is only, and I put that in quotation marks, only a subset of the holiness of Jerusalem. After that spot, something qualitatively changes when you had in the Temple Mount, but the Kotel itself, the wall itself, is still part of Jerusalem. It's the entryway. It's a vestibule. It's an artery. For others, it's a historical spot. It's a place in which it stops right there. And therefore, it always commemorates a certain form of mourning. It becomes the wailing wall. It's the spot of destruction. People don't want to move any further than that. But nonetheless, they feel very deeply the historical associations with it. From a religious point of view, for those who want to have a large heart and are very traditional, there should be a way of finding space. And we'll go to the details of the plans. For everyone, it's really not a place of community prayer. It always was a place, it continues to be a place, that the real definitive notion of the Kotel is this place of Bakashat Yachid, the personal request, the personal going, the personal communion. And for those who really want the public notion, well, the public notion is messianic. Where can we go from here, and when does that time start? It's a volatile issue, but nonetheless, it's correct. And therefore, people with a large heart should be able to find places for each other, should be, find a way. The Kotel is not Har HaBayit. The wall is not the future reality for those of us who believe, the future reality of the temple holiness. We still live at a time in which we're not able to shake away from ourselves. Can't figure out how to shake away from ourselves. Our tumat meist, our death impurity, our broken up situation that we still live in an imperfect world. And therefore, this is the last spot we can go to. We've made out of the Kotel a spot in which many historical echoes are there, and many future possibilities are there. It can also be a spot in which we can begin to find ourselves, people in all forms of the spectrum. It'd be a great challenge when and if the Kotel is enlarged and there's a spot for those who are not full traditionalists. How will they find the way to their own way to the Kotel? Find members of their own affiliation who will go there more than just for a bar or bat mitzvah, but go there on a consistent basis, which will allow their own members to find their universal experience of crying at the Kotel, of seeing beyond the Kotel, feeling that you're standing before God. That's not an easy spiritual path for anyone. And that will be a challenge, as it will be a challenge for the great traditionalists who want to continue to see the Kotel as a place for great service, as a vestibule to future times. And with that, I would say, an ability to be generous and to be open-hearted. It's a great time. It's a great opportunity for all to deepen both our love for our fellow human beings, for our fellow Jews, and to deepen our appreciation for spirituality and what things may be. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Landes. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.